The Clash of the Two Americas, Volume 1, The Unfinished Symphony, was written by Matthew Arrett and Cynthia Chung, and published by the Canadian Patriot Press. This recording is narrated by Hugh Patrick Trudeau. Chapter 13, Today's Multipolar Alliance and the Missed Chance of 1867. In the last chapter, we were introduced to the U.S.-Russian Grand Design, which shaped not only the sale of Alaska in October 1867 to the USA for $7.2 million, but also Russia's involvement in the American Civil War, as Tsar Alexander II arranged the deployment of Russian Navy fleets to San Francisco and New York. Even though President Lincoln and Tsar Alexander II were both known as great reformers and emancipators for their common commitment to free slaves and serfs, both leaders were assassinated before their grand visions could come to fruition. Lincoln in 1865 and Alexander II in 1881. I would like now to present another chapter of this forgotten history. The creation of modern Canada as an anti-republican confederation designed explicitly to prevent the inevitable construction of a Russian-American rail connection through the Bering Strait in the wake of the Civil War. The strategic value of the Bering Strait Tunnel in history. The original grand design for the Bering Strait Rail Tunnel was driven by a plan to connect telegraph lines between continents, followed soon thereafter by a connection of the Trans-Siberian Railway and America's transcontinental railways through British Columbia, Alaska, and into Eurasia, as laid out spectacularly by former Colorado Governor William Gilpin. The idea of the Bering Strait Tunnel was supported by Tsar Nicholas II, who, in 1906, hired a team of American engineers to conduct feasibility studies on the initiative, which then had an estimated cost of $350 million. Sadly, a couple of world wars and a disastrous revolution kept this project from blossoming as it was intended. This idea was revived again by FDR's great vice president, Henry Wallace, who discussed the project at length with Russia's foreign minister Molotov in 1942. Describing this project in 1944, Wallace stated in Survey Graphic magazine, "Of all nations, Russia has the most powerful combination of a rapidly increasing population, great natural resources, and immediate expansion in technological skills. Siberia and China will furnish the greatest frontier of tomorrow. When Molotov was in Washington in the spring of 1942, I spoke to him about the combined highway and airway, which I hope someday will link Chicago and Moscow via Canada, Alaska, and Siberia. Molotov, after observing that no one nation could do this job by itself, said that he and I would live to see the day of its accomplishment. It would mean much to the peace of the future if there could be some tangible link of this sort between the pioneer spirit of our own West and the frontier spirit of the Russian East." Again, the Cold War derailed this project, and it was only in 2007 that the Russian government revived it once again, with President Putin even offering to pay two-thirds of the $65 billion estimated cost to construct the 100-kilometer tunnel across the Bering Strait. This project was offered to the West more loudly in 2011, and again in May 2014, China unofficially gave their backing to the initiative. Sadly, unipolar technocrats and neocons controlling NATO foreign policy had not the eyes to see what benefits such projects offered those who joined in its construction, and instead continued in their zero-sum game plan for full-spectrum dominance. With the 2018 unveiling of the Polar Silk Road, extending the east-west development corridors into the Arctic, which have merged increasingly with Russia's Eurasian Economic Union and Putin's Far East vision, the Bering Strait connection has again been given new life. If nations of the West find the courage to let go of the Titanic before the hellish chaos of the oncoming financial meltdown erupts, then the projects animating the new multipolar paradigm will undoubtedly look a lot like the world land bridge concept illustrated by the Schiller Institute in the accompanying map. Arctic development remains one of the best strategic points of alliance and cooperation needed to reorganize the collapsing world economic order around firm principles of multipolar cooperation and value, and, as such, is not too different from the dynamics shaping the world when Lincoln took office in 1860. The 19th century clash of two systems. Lincoln's economic advisor and leader of the international export of the American system of political economy, Henry C. Carey, described this clash between two systems in his 1851 book, Harmony of Interests. Two systems are before the world. The one looks to increasing the proportion of persons and of capital engaged in trade and transportation, and therefore to diminishing the proportion engaged in producing commodities with which to trade, with necessarily diminished return to the labor of all, while the other looks to increasing the proportion engaged in the work of production and diminishing that engaged in trade and transportation, with increased return to all, giving to the laborer good wages and to the owner of capital good profits. One looks to pauperism, ignorance, depopulation, and barbarism. The other to increasing wealth, comfort, intelligence, combination of action, and civilization. One looks towards universal war, the other towards universal peace. One is the English system. The other we may be proud to call the American system, for it is the only one ever devised, the tendency of which was that of elevating while equalizing the condition of man throughout the world. Carey, just like British Empire's Lord Palmerston, clearly recognized that America had not completed the mission of 1776, since not one but two Americas existed within Washington. One positive America, representing the anti-slavery, anti-colonial principles of the 1789 Constitution, versus another hypocritical slave power that never believed that all men were created equal. Just as two antithetical impulses existed within America, so too did two opposing views of manifest destiny co-evolve since 1776. One hellish version, driven by the principle of spreading slavery and suppressing the weak, while the other, more noble impulse, was represented by the spirits of Lincoln, Carey, and Gilpin. This fatal contradiction within the Republic was exploited fervently by Anglo-American intelligence for 80 years before the inevitable Civil War finally broke out in 1861. President Lincoln defined the terms of this contradiction and imminent war in an 1858 debate with the slave power's champion, Stephen Douglas, saying, "That is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself shall be silent. It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. They are the two principles that have stood face to face from the beginning of time, and will ever continue to struggle. The one is the common right of humanity, and the other, the divine right of kings." This quote is important, as it addresses the fact that Lincoln recognized correctly the inextricable connection between the institution of slavery, even when it masqueraded under a republican veneer, and monarchical principles of colonialism, which saw mankind's right to rule defined not by morality or merit, but rather by principles of hereditary right. The anti-Union Confederacy that succeeded. On July 1, 1867, the British North America Act was enacted, consolidating Britain's other anti-American Confederacy operation under a new constitution, dedicating the new federation's existence to be conducive to the welfare of the provinces and promote the interests of the British Empire. It should be kept in mind that the project to confederate, actually began during the Civil War in the form of the week-long booze-soaked Charlottetown Convention of 1864, which hammered out the resolutions later put into law in 1867. Some have wondered why, just days before the July 1, 1867 enactment, would-be Confederate President Jefferson Davis gave a speech to cheering crowds in Lennoxville, Quebec, stating, "I hope that you will hold fast to your British principles and that you may ever strive to cultivate close and affectionate connections with the mother country." This pro-British gushing from a Confederate traitor in Quebec shouldn't be surprising at all if we take into account the fact that Montreal and Toronto served as Southern Confederacy bases of operation, used with the full support of the British Empire to run terrorist operations, raids, espionage, and financing of the war against Lincoln's forces from the north, while Canada officially maintained an air of neutrality. As Barry Sheehy pointed out in Montreal, City of Secrets, during the Civil War, the largest Confederate Secret Service base outside Richmond, Virginia, was located in Montreal, under the direct control of Confederate Secretary of State Judah Benjamin, himself an asset of British intelligence. Much like the exiled Russian and Hong Kong oligarchs and traitors of the modern day, Jefferson Davis and Judah Benjamin and many other Confederate rebels lived out their days in comfort in both Canada and Britain. Benjamin becoming an English barrister in London from 1865 until his death in 1884. The sale of Alaska and the rush for British Columbia. On March 30, 1867, the British Empire was caught off guard when the news that Russia's Alaskan possessions had been sold to America for $7.2 million in a secretive diplomatic maneuver that Secretary of State William Seward described as the most important deal of his life. The sale had suddenly made the isolated colony of British Columbia very hot real estate. During this 1867 purchase, Lincoln's Transcontinental Railway, begun in 1863 at the height of the Civil War, was a mere 2 years from completion, linking the Pacific to the Atlantic for the first time in history, and thus destroying the British monopoly over maritime shipping routes. With students of Lincoln's program to be found among the intelligentsia of Russia, led by Count Sergei Witte and Dmitry Mendeleev, the American-modeled Trans-Siberian Railway's construction was not far away, and the linking of rail across the two continents was discussed as a real possibility by Republican visionaries the world over. The chances that British Columbia would join Confederation were minute at this time, as the isolated colony had no ties of commerce to Britain or the East Coast Confederacy, 3,500 kilometers away. In fact, on July 2, 1867, the first of several petitions was sent to Queen Victoria, requesting that either the colony's debt burdens and economic woes be alleviated by the mother country, or that the Queen grant them permission to annex to the USA. At this time, American consul to Victoria, Alan Francis, wrote a letter to the President stating, "Even the colonists claiming most loyalty to the Queen are now urging with great unanimity annexation to the United States as their only salvation, as the only means of retrieving the colonies from their present embarrassment and decline." BC's colonialist newspaper described the situation in the following terms. "Since no change would be for the worse, British Columbians would welcome annexation to the United States to continuing in a state of poverty and wretchedness. In writing this, we know we speak the mind of 9 out of every 10 men in the colony. The sentiment is heard at every gathering street corner, at social gatherings, in business circles, in all places." On July 18, 1868, the Hudson Bay Territories, also known as Rupert's Land, were sold to Ottawa under an operation led by Sir Georges Etienne Cartier, who stated, In this country, we must have a distinct form of government in which the monarchical spirit will be found. Cartier's monarchical spirit was reflected in Canada's leading fathers of Confederation, such as Sir John A. Macdonald, who famously stated, "A British subject I was born, and a British subject I will die," and who, looking to the vast wilderness west of Toronto, said in 1867, "I would be quite willing to personally leave the whole country a wilderness for the next half century, but I fear if Englishmen do not go there, the Yankees will." On May 22, 1867, Father of Confederation Sir Alexander Galt stated British policy for Western expansion, that is, to block the connection between Russia and the USA, saying, "If the United States desire to outflank us on the West, we must accept the situation and lay our hand on British Columbia and the Pacific Ocean. This country cannot be surrounded by the United States. We are gone if we allow it. From the Atlantic to the Pacific must be the cry in British America, as much as it ever has been in the United States." The last serious effort by British Columbians to join America was made with the Annexation Petition of 1869, listing BC's desperate grievances with the Empire and appealing to President Grant. "The only remedy for the evils which beset us, we believe to be in a close union with the adjoining states and territories. We are already bound to them by a unity of object and interest. Nearly all our commercial relations are with them. They furnish the chief markets we have for the products of our mines, lands, and waters. They supply the colony with most of the necessities of life. They furnish us the only means of communication with the outer world. For these reasons, we earnestly desire the acquisition of this colony by the United States." The Alabama Claims. The last great hope for extending Lincoln's rail through BC into Alaska at this time arose amidst the 1869-1871 Alabama Claims Affair, which saw the world's first international trial in Geneva address the matter of Britain's military support for the Confederacy during the Civil War. Britain's air of neutrality was betrayed by her construction of Confederate warships that unleashed havoc on Lincoln's navy. The court ruled in favor of America, and soon Britain came close to losing its Canadian possessions as payment for their crimes. Senator Charles Sumner and Secretary Seward both advocated this course, but weaker figures in America ended up agreeing to a measly $15 million settlement in 1872, while all wrongs were forgotten. With these failures to capture the pregnant moment, the effort to assimilate BC into London's Northern Confederacy was accelerated. Negotiations began on June 7, 1870, and within weeks, nearly all resolutions and clauses were agreed upon. The two biggest impediments to BC's entry into the Confederation were dealt with by the payment of all the colony's debts by Ottawa, and the promise made by Macdonald to construct a rail line linking the new province with Montreal and Quebec within 10 years. This promised rail line was necessary in order to sabotage the intention of the American Manifest Destiny policy. The Empire Strikes Back. With these arrangements agreed upon, and with similar arrangements in the former Red River settlement in today's Manitoba, British Columbia was admitted into Confederation as the 6th Canadian province. Within the coming decades, as Canada was opened up to form a British-controlled Northern Confederacy blockade against the civilizing progress of the sovereign nation-state intention of the United States, Saskatchewan and Alberta were formed as provinces where there had formerly been only Hudson's Bay land. The lack of progress on Canada's rail by 1878 had resulted in renewed disenchantment on part of British Columbians, who demanded once more for annexation into the USA, resulting in Sir John A. Macdonald's national policy of 1878-1885, which forced the construction of Canada's own transcontinental rail, With the inaugural train cars arriving in BC's Port Moody from Montreal on the 4th of July, 1885. By the time of the 1876 Centennial Exhibition in Philadelphia, the American system of political economy had resulted in a great explosion of wealth in the United States and became a model for the whole civilized world seeking to break free of British colonial hegemony. Lovers of progress from around the world who came to the convention were converted to the American system. Germany, under Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, vigorously applied American system practices of high protective tariffs and vast internal improvements under his Zollverein. Tsars Alexander II and III and their close circle of Russian advisors applied the American model for the vast modernization of Russia vectored around the Trans-Siberian Railway. Even Japan, under the Meiji Restoration, applied the American model to escape feudalism and enter the modern age. Sadly, an age of London-financed revolutions, assassinations, and wars misshaped the 1880s, 1890s, and the 20th century, preventing this system of win-win cooperation from evolving as it was destined to. Today, the world is again pulled by two opposing systems represented by Lincoln's international allies on the one hand and British intelligence on the other. Although today's champions of the multipolar world of cooperation have names like Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, these Eurasian statesmen have ushered in a new system of credit, diplomacy, security, economic, and science policy, governed by the best principles displayed by the American system of the 19th century and occasionally revived, albeit only briefly, under such 20th century leaders as Franklin Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy. Whether the Western nations have the moral fortitude to recover their lost traditions and join in this new paradigm or not, yet remains to be seen.